Okay, good morning, everybody. Good to see you all. Our learning today is sponsored by Moshe and Tzipporah Boim in memory of Moshe's brother, David Boim, David Reuven, Ben Alexander Ziskin, Alva Shalom, and Larry and Elaine Grossman in memory of Larry's father, Hyman Grossman, Harav Chaim Zev, Ben Reb Meir, Alva Shalom. May Neshamot have Aliyot. Our learning will be in their memory. May their memory continue to be a blessing. We are on Daf Chaf Gimel. And I think for the only time in the Masechet, we are precisely starting with the first word on the daf, after it says Gimel Mem Gemara, we start with the question, My Tama. To set the stage, we've just done the penultimate Mishnah. That was the end of Chaf Bet Amud Bet, which was a long Mishnah that basically asked the question of what is the procedure for lashes? What is a whip made of? We said the whip's made of calf hide. It's folded in certain ways. There's some donkey hide attached to it. We said, what is the position of the culprit or the felon when they're being lashed? And we said that their hands are tied to either side of a post. They are not standing and they're not sitting. They're not lying. They kind of crouch down as a result of being tied. The whip is described as coming around the body, over the back and reaching to the stomach. We said there are psukim that are being read as this is happening. It gave a whole description. So that's the penultimate Mishnah. We're going to do the final Mishnah at the bottom of the first Amud today, which will lead us in to the end of the Masechet. But the first Amud itself is a reflection on so many of the details I just mentioned about that last Mishnah. And the first four words of the Amud are the most confusing to the commentators, because the opening question is, My Tama, what's the reason? And of course, the question the commentators ask is, what's the reason for what? And there are like 14 details in the Mishnah, and there are 14 different readings. Oh, it's asking why are they tied to the post? Or it's asking why do we read the psukim? Or why is it made of calf hide? All sorts of potential questions, and without getting into the details, it seems to me one way we can resolve it is the overwhelming sensation that we get from that Mishnah is so there's a lot of thought that goes into how these lashes happen, that you're tied to a post in a particular way, that it's psukim are read in a certain order, that it's made of particular material. And the Gemara's first instinct is, what is this all about? Why are there so many details? The Torah just says hit. Just hit the guy. Nowhere in the Torah does it say it's got to be made in a certain way. It's got to be certain amot wide. It's got to be certain amot long. It's got to reach. Why all these details? And the Gemara response is, Mishum Nikle, because it says demeaned. Torah says, you shall be smote, you shall be hit, and demeaned, your brother shall be demeaned. And that word, nikle, is key, because for Chazal, at the end of this Masechet, we are re-emphasizing the purpose of punishment is not to unleash divine wrath in human hands. It is to rehabilitate the criminal. There are certain sins that we deem beyond rehabilitation for which the punishment is. Well, Karis will come to, it's interesting, but what's, I guess, maybe not quite as bad metaphysically, but in physical terms is quite bad, death. So when there's a punishment, capital punishment, good morning, when the punishment is death, rehabilitation's beyond the question, and that's actually dealt with in Sanhedrin. We don't have any attention really put on Chiv Misa in Marcos. The issue here is, what about punishments that are not about eradicating the person? And it's worth noting, what do we imagine is the most humane punishment in contemporary Western society? Somebody commits a crime, it's not a crime, or let's say it's not a civil crime, they don't owe anybody money, but they've cheated on their taxes, or they've... Yeah, we tend to assume jail is the most humane version of a punishment. You know, whipping... Well, penalty, fine, we imagine, is most humane, but we tend to imagine that in the civic context. You owe somebody money, you committed damages. I guess cheating on taxes, you might say, just give them a fine. But if you want to offer punitive damages rather than just repaying, do they ever do that? If somebody commits tax fraud, do they ever give you a penalty, just randomly ascribed amount of money? Or you pay what you owe and you go to jail?
Well, technically, you pay for the services that... let's say the IRS, whatever it is, you would have to pay them for their quote-unquote...
For their time.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. So so that's not a fine, right? That's compensation. But
we call it a fine or a penalty.
A penalty.
Depends on how much.
Right. Okay. Interesting. But am I right that jail time is always part and parcel of that discussion, or sometimes you just get the penalty? I guess you're right, it depends on how much. If someone commits a massive tax fraud program, they're going to go to jail. If somebody, you know, didn't pay properly a few $100 here and there, but regularly, I imagine, I don't know. But we do tend to imagine the most humane punitive measure that is not monetary is prison. I don't think there is any state in the U.S. where corporal punishment is issued. Am I right? Nobody whips anybody. Nobody lashes anybody. We tend to assume that any physical infliction of pain, bodily pain, is problematic. But locking people up, we think, you know what, I'm not touching them. They're just in jail. So death penalty, we're kind of putting in a different bracket. But you're right, that is capital punishment. And that does exist in certain states. But corporal... So there are many... So we'll, I guess we could talk about bail as well. You know, actually, Shavuos night, 1 a.m, we'll be talking about bail in passing. But nowhere in this Masechta do we talk about prison. For Chazal, that does not seem to be a mainstream humane punishment. And in fact, in contemporary Jewish rabbinic thought, that is generally agreed to. Prison is not considered a humane. It's less bodily infliction of pain. But psychologically, the torment of being locked up and the message it sends is not rehabilitation. People often say, oh, they go to prison to be rehabilitated. How many people actually go to prison and get rehabilitated? Most people getting locked up. And we tend as a public to think the longer they're locked up, the better because they're off the streets. But the idea that they're going to be locked up and demeaned and stripped of their identity and taken away from their family. And then after a few years, they're going to be, you know what, maybe I should live a better life. It's very rare. That occasionally people find religion in jail. More often than not, people get radicalized in jail. And the idea, we tend to kind of recoil at the idea of beating people as being humane. And I'm not recommending we do it. But the rabbinic view tends to be that Malchus is actually intended to be more humane than locking people up. It's meant to make people in a moment be reflexive, regret, have remorse and change path in a way that they're not taken away from their family or taken out of society and reminded. I should note in Sanhedrin, there is a discussion of something called the kippah. Anyone familiar with the kippah? Not the one on my head. But the kippah was a place where if somebody couldn't quite be put to death with capital punishment because they'd met the technical requirements, they were edim, they were warned, but the Beis Din knew, not guessed, but knew that they had committed a capital crime, they would be put in this dome called the kippah and they would be fed barley for days and water. And the combination of those foods would essentially lead to an inflated intestines and it would essentially kill them, not through capital punishment means, but it would be a slow inflicted, we need to get you out of society. And another example, Sanhedrin, is if somebody keeps doing the same Malchus prohibition, we don't just say every week, all right, you've done your stuff, let's give you Malchus and go back to society, bless you. That this is meant to be rehabilitation. This is not just a tit for tat, you commit a crime, we give you lashes, let's go back and forth. This is meant to be a moment. So these first four words, my tama, what is all this about, Mishum Nikla? This is about shame. The whole purpose of Malchus is about inducing a psychological reaction that what you have done needs to stop and you cannot reoffend. So those first four words are ambiguous and complicated, but I think set the stage for what this punishment is all about and what that Mishnah implies, as we'll get to the details. Why is it made out of calf? If I had to ask you without looking any further, why might we say it should be made out of calf hide? And you were thinking, like a rabbi giving a sermon, what message might be embedded in calf hide? Think about Jewish history. Egel HaZahav, you might think that this is trying to remind them that you're not the first to sin. And you won't be the last to sin, but you need to change your ways, think about the weight of what happened, etc., etc. And that's where they're not going to head in somewhere along those kind of lines. So, Amr of Sheshes, Meshuvah, Elazar ben Azariah. We've got four statements in the name of Sheshes and the name of Elazar ben Azariah. Number one, Minay le'resushi shel egel. How do I know that whip should be made out of calf? Dechtiv arba'im yakenu, because it says in the verse, you shall lash them 40 times. V'samech leilo tachsim shor b'disho. And right next to it, seemingly randomly, is the instruction that you cannot muzzle an ox while it is threshing. What is the connection between lashes and not muzzling an ox? There are many legal connections. For example, this is the prototypical prohibition, love, that you get lashes for, and it's used as the example for everything else. But Chazal say there's something more here, which is you can't muzzle an ox. That suggests that the ox hide should be the material out of which the whip is made. We're going to have another further three statements where through smichut, through juxtaposition of various verses, we're going to lead to various laws. So that was number one, the material of the whip. Number two. Good point. That a shor is an adult ox and an egel is a baby cow. And the assumption, by the way, the figure, the commentary on the right is not Rashi at this point in Markot, it's the Rivan. And he, among others, says, yeah, an egel, an ox, you know, iceberg, Goldberg, similar thing. But they're the same family. You're right. The idea egel zahav would come to mind more, and we'll see in a minute maybe there's another reason as well. So he says, number two, how do I know that in a case of yibum, somebody's happily married, unfortunately the husband passes away, they've not had any children, and the husband's got an unmarried brother. She now has an obligation to perform one of two things with her brother, former brother-in-law, either yibum or chalitza. And the Gemara is asking, how do we know she's got the possibility of chalitza? Maybe she just has to do the levirate marriage as an obligation. How do I know if she gets his brother mukah shchin and he's afflicted with diseases, she'en chosmei mata, that she is not muzzled, meaning she has the opportunity to express herself and say, I don't want this. How do we know you can do that? Dechtiv lo tachsam shor b'disho, it says you shall not muzzle the ox in their threshing. V'samech li kiyetru achin yakdav, and that's exactly the context it talks about yibam. So, kal v'chomer, if an ox can't be muzzled while it's threshing, a woman can't be muzzled in the process of establishing a marriage. So that was number two. Amrushesh l'mushum lazer ben azariah, kol emavazet hamodim, whoever disgraces the moadim, the festivals, mean chol moed for the commentators, kilu avid avid azariah, it's as if you have worshipped idols. Dichtiv el maseich alot haselach, it says you shall not make molten gods. V'samech le'en chagamatzot tishman, it says you shall observe the holiday of Pesach, the festival of Pesach, and the conjunction of those two things again tells you, I have to keep the chagim, and I can't make molten gods. What on earth is the connection? Rav Shesha says, in the name of his teacher, if you disgrace the holidays, it's the equivalent of idolatry. And again, if we had more time, we could establish a connective tissue between these four statements, where we're joining together two verses, the material of the hide, the non-muzzling of a potential yavama, the disgrace of holidays, and Rav Shesha's Mimim Lazim Anazariah. Fourth comment, Kol Mesab Loshen Hara, Kol Mekab Loshen Hara, Kol Meidei Lusheke, whoever tattletales in Lashon Hara, or believes Lashon Hara, or testifies falsely, Ra'u Lashicha L'kavim, it is befitting they should be thrown to the dogs. It says in the context of Nevela, if you've got meat that isn't kosher, what should you do with it? Give it to the dogs. With Samech, meaning it's not Asa Bahana, you can give it to the dogs. Samech Lein, right next to it, Lotis Asham Ashav, you shall not carry a false witness. For Karibe Nami, Lotasi, and you can also read it with a slightly grammatical change, suggesting not only that you shouldn't bear false witness, but you shouldn't cause it to be born, meaning you shouldn't believe it and you shouldn't tell it. Full stop. Those are four comments made by Rav Sheshes through Smichut. The material of the whip is made of calf height. Disgracing the holidays is like idolatry. Muzzling a woman in the context of Yibum is prohibited. You have to give her the chance to speak. And false testimony and Lashon Hara is the equivalent of being needed thrown to the dogs. Full stop. Continuing, and we've got to blast through because it's a long amud. The Shteret Suot, and the Mishnah on the previous page said the two whips are made out of ox hide, and there are two strings at the end made of donkey hide. Shel Chamor is taught in the Brayta. Kedidarish Agla Aleder of Chista. This Galilean once expounded why it should be made out of donkey and ox. Yada shor koneu v'chamro evos ba'alav Yisrael lo yada. Anyone know where that's from? Excellent. Right. In the sheet I've given you, right on the right-hand side, in that small margin, that's where you have the references. This is an old typeset, despite the nekudot, the vowels. but it gives you the perek and the book. So that's taken from the first chapter of Isaiah, which we read as one of the Haftorahs, which is the chastisement of the Jewish people. Say, you know, what happens when you hit a donkey? It does what you want. What happens when you train a dog? Or if you walk in and you say, sit, the dog sits.
Hopefully.
Animals tend to know who their master is and respond to it. And this is what Yeshayahu begins. Yada shar koneu, the ox knows its master. V'chama avos yiva'alav, and the donkey responds to its owner. Yisrael lo yada, but the Jews have no idea. We are worse than the animals, is how Yeshayahu begins. We don't recognize our master. Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, yava mish makir avos ba'alav, yifurem mish einu makir avos ba'alav. So according to this Galilean, who learned in the study of Rav Chisda, why do I whip them with an ox hide and donkey hide? You know, if you were thinking in historical archaeological terms, you might think, well, it was a cheap material, or it inflicted the most pain, or if it was the most long-lasting material. And here, this Galilean says, well, actually, again, the whole point is to remind you, you're meant to be listening to God. This is not about inflicting pain per se. This is a rehabilitative moment, and we're using the hide of animals that responds to tell you be more responsive to God. Recognize the import of these laws. Yada tefach. We said it's got to be a tefach wide, the handle, and we described how long the whip was. It has to reach over the body and go to the stomach. Some of you may be aware people have different sized stomachs. People have different sized backs. So if I say, oh, how long should the whip be? It should be long enough to reach right in the middle of the person's stomach. So you can have, how many people live, how many people are punished by the criminal justice system every year? Thousands and thousands and thousands. You can have thousands and thousands of whips every time there's a new person. You have to get a new whip so it's exactly the right dimensions. Rabbi says, it makes it sound like every person has a whip made specially for them. And again, you could imagine, homiletically, that would be a good idea, that every person should have a punishment that precisely fits them. Amale Rava, Imke Navish Luritsu Estuvi, says it's impossible that they would have that many whips. You'd just be gathering whips and have none to do with them. Elama Rava, Rava says this must be. Avkata Idbe, it had a slip knot in the middle of the whip. Kibai Miktabe, Kibai Marpele. And if this was a tall person, they would extend it. If it was a short person, they shorten it. So it was one whip, but it would be adjusted precisely to this person. So you managed to keep that spirit alive, that this punishment is not the faceless reaction of the justice system. This is tailored to you to help you be more attentive to responsibility. Malkinato, they are whipped while they are bent down, and they are whipped two-thirds on the on the back, one-third on the front. First word on the line is manan emili. Manan emili, how do I know this, that you divide it into thirds? Amar of Hakana, Rav Kana says, Amar Krat says in the verse, v'hipilu ha-shofet, the shofet makes them fall down, v'yikau lefanav and whips them. Lefanav literally means before him, meaning before the judge, but it means before, in front of him in this context. Kedei v'shato b'mispar, and then it has two words afterwards to say, risha acha milefanav. A third of the lashes are on the front, and two of the wickednesses are on the back, and that's how you divide it up, which is why we said last time, when you're assessing the number of lashes, it has to be divisible by three. It has to have one-third on the front, two-thirds on the back. So if you, the doctor assesses you can get 20 lashes, how many do you end up getting? 18. It's always going to go down to the nearest number divisible by three. To divide it up in this way. Again, the Gemara doesn't say at this point, okay, but why? Why do you have some on the front and some on the back? And I can leave that with you, why that might be important.
Why does he give him 20 if he knows it's going to be taken down to 18 anyway?
Say again?
Why would the judge say 20 lashes?
Oh, the doctor might say.
Down to 18?
That's true. So they ask the doctor, how many can they withstand? And the doctor says, I'm not in the business of punishment. I'm just making an assessment. They can take 20 lashes. And the judge says, all right, 18. And at which point you slip the doctor a five and see how, and then he says, five? Says, okay, here's the 100, and then they bring it down. In Malkinoto, the Mishnah continued, you have to fold over the whip so that it's got multiple ends on the lash. Amar of Chista, Amar Yab Yochanan, Munadus Hoshi Mechopela. How do I know that you should fold it? First one line, Shnei Amar, Vihipilu, it says, and you shall make him bend over, but you can also read it as it should be bent over. So it sounds like the pasuk is describing the whip needs to be doubled over. But we already use that word to say that the person needs to be bent over. It should have said then yatou, bend over. What is fall over mean? Shema min atarde teaches two things. So the verse that says the whip, the judge should make it bend over, is speaking both to the human being who has to be inclined and to the whip that has to be bent over. Now here's a question for you. I can't remember who told me that. Was it you, Jerry, was telling me the joke last week? Yeah, about the German, the Frenchman, and the Jew who are all about to be whipped. And they said, but out of kindness, we'll let you have one thing on your back and you can decide what to have. The Frenchman said, I want French oil, fabulous French oils lathered on my back. Says, okay, sets up the Frenchman, starts hitting, oi, oi, but he makes it through with the oil, and the German gets the German shepherd, says, I don't want anything on my back, I'll take it. And he starts whipping, the German just goes, and goes to the Jew, what do you want? And he says, I want the German on my back. So here the question is, who do you appoint to do the whipping? Who would you want to do the whipping if you were about to get lashed?
Somebody weak.
So there is a debate here. Tana Rabban and the rabbi saw first word in the line Shema Minai, instead in the orange. Ein ma'amidin chazanin, the appointee of the court to do the lashes, we only appoint chasire koach v'yeteri mada, someone who is weak and intelligent. Meaning you go to the local library and you find someone who spends their days in study and you say, you're going to be the Bet Din whipper. And you say, what are you talking about? I can barely carry these books. Perfect. You're the guy for us. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, afilu chaseri mada v'yeteri koach. Rabbi Yehuda says not particularly. It can be somebody who's not that smart, intellectually speaking, but has a huge amount of power. Amar Rava. Rava says kvatei Rabbi Yehuda mistavri. It makes a lot of sense according to Rabbi Yehuda, who said it can be somebody strong but not smart. Dichtiv lo Yosef pen Yosef. There is a warning in the verse that we say to the appointee, don't do one more lash than has been assessed. You're not allowed to do any more. And if I'm talking like this, saying, remember, don't do one more than expected, who does it sound like I'm talking to if I'm speaking like that? Somebody deeply intelligent or somebody who's kind of a brute force figure who's just representing the Beis Din? Sounds like I'm kind of talking to somebody who's not that intellectually rigorous and is just doing what they're told. We say, be very careful, don't get carried away. So it makes sense to Rabbi Yehuda. It makes a lot of sense if this is not somebody who's been intellectually trained. First one line is mada. That's why you need to warn them. If you're saying this is somebody, you go into the library, you have to start telling them, remember, don't do more on the necessary. You know, I just came from studying relativity theory. I think I can cope with the idea that you've told me 18 and no more. Stop telling me. Rabbanan, what are the rabbis going to say? You say you can even have somebody who's come from the library. They say, En mazarzin elem zaraz. Says, you want to know what warning works? Warning works with somebody who is attentive to what they're meant to be doing. You could, warn a brute figure a million times and they're going to go, oh, I don't really know. I'm just going to keep hitting. They're not paying attention. But if somebody is intellectually rigorous, everybody is capable of making mistakes. And if somebody is intellectually rigorous, they're more likely to respond to a warning well. So actually, we've got a debate here between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbanan as to who is most teachable. Is it the intellectuals who are most teachable and do they require warnings? Or is it the kind of brute force figures who are not intellectually trained? Tana, I should have put a change of color here. Tana was taught in a brighter Kushumag Bia when the appointee lifts up the whip to hit, should lift it up with two hands, magbir b'shtei yadav, kashu maka, but when they hit down, strike down, maka b'yado acha, they should use only one hand, ki hechi delatim indidei, so that the whip comes from them. And it's not clear what that means, that they have to hit with one hand. Any of you baseball players? Have you ever played baseball? How many hands do you hold on the bat when you hit?
Two.
Two? Right. And that's true. What about tennis? And you play tennis? Any tennis players?
Usually one.
Usually one. I've seen it. Anyone familiar with Andy Murray?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was the first British person to win Wimbledon in like a million years. So I've seen when he does backhand, he uses two hands, which I always think looks very strange to me. And some prefer that. I don't know why. I guess they're different skills and adjectives. But here the suggestion is when you use one hand, either you've got more precision, or it's more personal, or it's stronger, maybe. And that's why... I would imagine with two hands you get more power. There are some who suggest we'll actually get more power with one hand. I don't know why that would be. I don't know. Any of you ever, like...
One hand to backhand versus two hands to backhand. Two hands to backhand have more power than one hand to backhand.
Is that true? It could be it's more precise because you've got two hands, but it's less power because the muscles are counteracting each other. I don't know. But I guess we'll try it someday when one of us does some sport. Vahakora... Someone was telling me yesterday to get membership at Cunningham Park for tennis. It's not that crazy. But it's just wasted money, isn't it? Because I'm not actually going to go.
Pickleball.
I have pickles.
It's different.
Yeah, you've got to run around. We'll see. I know it'll be wasted money because I don't have a tennis racket and I'm never going to buy one. So we'll figure it out. Vahakore Kore. The Mishnah continued. There is a verse. There are three verses, four in fact, that are being read. As this is being carried out, all of which suggest we're not hitting you because we hate you. We're not hitting you because you're a delinquent and this is what you deserve. We are trying to rehabilitate you. Pay attention to God. Live well. Follow the mitzvot for your own sake to make your life more redemptive, which is kind of the theme that will emerge into the final Mishnah of this Masechta. So, Tana Rabban and the rabbis taught in the green. Hagadol Sheba Dayanim, there are three Dayanim on this panel and they oversee this punishment. I don't know what happens here when they do the capital punishment here. I know that they have a viewing window in a lot of facilities, and sometimes the family of the victim watches. Are there judges at a death penalty? I don't think so, right? They have some overseers in charge. But here the assumption is you've got the panel of three dayanim sitting there as the lashes are being carried out. Hagadol Sheba Dayanim Kore, and the most senior judge reads out these psukim. Hasheni Mone, the second most senior judge counts 1, 2, 3 as they go through. Vasheshi Omer Mahakeu, and the least senior judge says strike, strike, strike. So they split up the responsibilities in this way, which again tells you. So what is the most important? If the most senior judge is committing, is doing one of these behaviors, presumably that's the most important. The figure of authority you turn to. The psukim is the key. Somebody needs to say hit so that the guy knows when to do it. Somebody needs to keep track. Why is that important? To say we're not going any more than the letter of the law. And the most important is pay attention to the purpose here. We're not just hitting you. Hitting you is a requirement, but we're doing this to change you. And what we'll see as we get to these next coming lines is there are sorts of ways that this never would ever happen, that you could get out of this in theory. So the Gemara continues. The greatest said would read the psukim, the second would count, and the third would say hit. Bizman shemakam ruba ma'arech, at a time when there were many, many lashes, you'd have to stretch out the psukim. If there were 39 lashes, you'd have to read the psukim very slowly. Bizman shemakam awetim, like I say, if there were 3 lashes, you'd have to say how we do ma'arev. Do it very, very quickly, psukei dezimra. Va'anan tanan. Hold on a minute. We taught in the Mishnah, chazan, chozel et chilat tamikra. You'd go back to the beginning. Which makes it sound like there was a standard pace, and if you went all the way through the psukim, you started again. Mitzvah letzam, saying the Gemara says, yeah, you should try to be precise. But if you weren't precise and you finished psukim and there were still 5 lashes left, you wouldn't just let it go in silence. These makot had to be accompanied by psukim. So you'd go back to the beginning and start again. It would be completely inconceivable, says the Gemara, for these lashes to be doled out in silence. The purpose of them is for these psukim, and really the lashes are kind of the background to the psukim. Vahanan, sorry, next line. Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, Maka Rabba, Ein Li Ela Maka Rabba, Maka Moetim Minayin. It says, you shall not give any more Maka Rabba of these great beatings. So the Mishnah says, hold on a minute, it sounds like you can't do many great beatings. How do I know you can't do even more, one more than is required? What if you give one more extra by mistake? Talmud Loma, Lo Yosef. It says you shall not add, which sounds like even one. Imkain, Ma Talmud Loma Maka Rabba. So why just say Lo Yosef? Why did it say don't add of these great beatings? Limed al Rishonish Maka Rabba. To teach that the first beatings are called Maka Rabba. Do not add on the great beatings, meaning the one you've received, are done with full strength or have great weight, full stop. Nitkalkal. This was the very last two lines of the previous Mishnah, which I've neglected to summarize so far by mistake, which is, if a person in the process of being hit soiled themselves or wet themselves, you stop the whole process. So let's say they've been designated, you're going to get 18 lashes. Lash number three, the person had soiled themselves. It's finished. It's done. Why?
Embarrassment.
Because again, the word nikle is key. The whole purpose here is being demeaned. And if a person has been demeaned as part of this process, it's over. That's the whole purpose. It's done. So again, we said this last time or two times ago. Sounds like the ideal way out. If you're not enjoying these lashes, just soil yourself on number three and you're done. Again, and if you think, oh, well, that's the solution. Again, the whole purpose is to be shamed, and you're obviously going to be shamed by that. So it may be a strategic way out, but you can't imagine it's a very good one. So Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, Echad Ha'ish, we're now going to have three opinions in a braita. We only had two in the Mishnah. The first opinion in the Mishnah was men or women soiling or wetting themselves are exempt from lashes. And we're now going to have three different views that don't take that across the board. Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, Echad Ha'ish, Echad Ha'isha, Brave Lo B'mayim. The first view in this Mishnah, Divrei B'meir, says that only if somebody soils themselves, men or women, but wetting yourself is not an exemption for the context of lashes. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Ha'ish Bereva Ish B'mayim. We had this view in the Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda says, women, if they wet themselves, that's embarrassing enough, but men have to soil themselves in order to be exempt. Chachamim Merman, the sages taught, Echad Ha'ish Echad Ha'isha Ben Bereva Ben B'mayim. The sages say, it doesn't matter, men or women, soiling or wetting yourselves, you're exempt. That is enough shame or demeaning. Vahatanya, hold on, Rabbi Yehuda said, a man has to soil themselves, but a woman, if they wet themselves, they're exempt. Rabbi Yehuda, Omer Ha'echad Ha'ish V'echad Ha'isha Barei. But we taught in a brighter somewhere, Rabbi Yehuda says, both of them are with soiling themselves. So how can we suggest in this brighter that he says a woman can wet themselves to be exempt? Or Menachem Yitzchak, Shneim Shavim Barei. All it means in that brighter is, they're both exempt if they soil themselves, but women in addition, if they wet themselves, are exempt. Okay, full stop.
Is there anything about men striking the women versus having women do it or something like that?
Yeah, it's a good question.
I think that whether it's sneers or something like that, it would fall into the...
So it's interesting. In the discussions around treatment of women for Beis Din, there are times where the Gemara will talk about you don't rip the shirt of women for modesty purposes, and it should be more in private. But here it doesn't come up at all. It just comes up in passing. You know, at some point in my head, I would have said maybe we don't whip women. But this is where it's kind of referred that there's a way out. But you're right. There's no discussion of how modesty would unfold here. Although the Rishonim talk about it, it's not in the Gemara. So this is again, if you're thinking about strategies to get out of Malkus. Better than soiling yourself is what's about to come as an option. First one on the line is Bar, middle of the line. Amar Shmuel, Shmuel said, Kaftuhu, if the person was tied up to the post and they managed to escape, Varatz me Beit Din, and ran away from Beit Din, what do we do? Pater, exempt. Why are you exempt? So the assumption is, at the moment, you were tied up to a post. Is that demeaning? To be tied up to a post? Yeah, so the assumption is the demeaning already began and you now ran away, which interrupted the process. And once a process has been interrupted, we ask ourselves, have you already been demeaned? And if you've already been demeaned, we don't revisit it, it's done. So you were tied up, you've been demeaned, and you escaped. At this moment, the Gemara is assuming you've been demeaned enough, process is over. But now we can ask a question. Meitvei, we've got a brighter. Kala, if somebody soils themselves, Ben Rishon, Ben Mishneh, Potrinoto, we say, if somebody soiled themselves, whether it was on the first lash or on the second lash, you are exempt. Meaning once you have lifted up that whip and you're about to start, if somebody soils themselves, the process has begun, they've been demeaned, it's over. You never had a single lash. You're standing there and you wet yourself and it's horrific. Process is finished. You've now been demeaned. The process began. It comes to an end. Nifzika Ritsua. We said if the strap broke, meaning you lifted up the whip over your shoulder, you're about to whip it and it got caught on something and then it ripped, the process has been interrupted. So we have to assess, has the person been demeaned already or not? And we should start again. So I'll ask you, based on what we've taught about the case of being tied to the post and running away, I lift up my whip. It's over my shoulder. It rips. It gets broken. I need to fix it. Has the person already been demeaned? Because they're tied to the post. The assumption is it should be over. And yet, we said when it rips, bishnia potrinoto, if he's already had one lash, meaning the process has begun, he's pater. Brishona in potrinoto. If you haven't given him one whip yet, he's not pater. You've got to start again. We said, but he's already been tied to the post. Am I? Why? Lahavi ruts. It's just like the case of running away. And this is the Gemara says, oh no, we misunderstood that original case. What was demeaning about that first case? It was not that they'd been tied to the post. It was that they had run away. That's what was demeaning. The fact that they didn't take the punishment. Again, you might think people run away all the time from prison and punishment and police. Here the assumption is if somebody's fleeing the court, they will forever be known as the person who couldn't take the punishment, who ran away from the hand of justice. And that itself is embarrassing and demeaning. And that's what exempts them at that point, not being tied to the post. So we've now got it all covered. If you run away, if you soil yourself, you are demeaned. If it broke, you haven't been demeaned, so you've got to keep going. Tan Rabbanan, the rabbis taught. Amdu lecha sheyil kala. If the doctor, while assessing this person, you ask a doctor two questions when you bring a candidate for Malkus. Number one, how many can they take? And the doctor might say, oh, they can take 25 lashes. How many would they end up getting if you said 25? 24. Said, so you can get 25 lashes. And they said, okay, and secondarily, at what point do you judge that they're going to lose control of their bowels or bladder? And the doctor might say, oh, they can take 25, their muscles and their bone and their skin, they can take 25, but this person is going to lose control with the first whip. You whip them, they're going to wet themselves instantly. But they can take physically 25. At that point, we say, well, if you say they're going to wet themselves within one whip, pater, they're exempt. You don't get any. Because the assumption is it shouldn't begin with being demeaned. It should be a process. But if this is all going to be just pure shame, it can't work. This is what this brighter seems to be implying. Amdula shilakla kala potrinato. If it's assumed that with one whip you'll embarrass yourself by soiling yourself, you're pato. The chashiyese may bin kala, but if the doctor says they can get 25, so you're going to give them 24, but by 24 they will have wet themselves. Malkinoto, you do it, and if they do, they're exempt, and if not, you keep going till the end of the number. V'lo od, ela afilu kala bitchila malkinoto. And now the assumption is not only if the doctor says, but if the doctor says they're going to wet themselves before you even begin, meaning just the pressure of being in the waiting room, knowing they're about to be whipped, is going to lead them to soil themselves, you still go through the process. It's only if the first lash will coincide with being demeaned that it's not carried out. Shne'emar, v'yikao v'nikla, because the order of the verse is, you shall hit them and they shall be demeaned. V'lo shekalaka kfar bebeit, not they've already been demeaned. Full stop. End of a whole amud of reflection on one Mishnah about what is the purpose of lashes. It is to induce shame. And again, it seems like it's just buried here at the end of the Masechta, that if you run away, you are potter. If we catch you again, you don't get lashes. If you wet yourself, you don't get lashes. If the strap breaks after you've had one hit, you stop the process. There are all sorts of built-in mechanics to stop you really getting hit, or at least us recognizing the purpose of hitting is not, okay, we're just compensating for the crime you committed, but this is the most humane, it seems, way we can think of to make sure you don't commit this crime again. So the question we've had in the past in passing is, well, what about today? You're at a halachic state. Would we give out Malkus? And we've said that for many today, religious law, we would not enforce. For example, eating pig. We might not want to enforce that in Beit Din. What about when it comes to harm? When you commit a crime against another person's property or lashes, is lashes an option rather than jail? What are the mechanics of punishment? In Israel right now, do they do prison? Yeah, jail is used in Israel. It's used all over the world, jail is used. What would we replace jail with if we were to replace it? It sounds like maybe we'd have some sort of structure where corporal punishment would be doled out, but we'd find a way to build in that it is not taken advantage of as a ways to hit people and hurt people, but it's about creating change. I was going to talk about a couple of weeks ago on Shabbos, and it ended up not being pertinent, about corporal punishment in schools where kids get hit in school. When was it made illegal in the United States?
It's still legal.
It is still legal. Is it still legal in New York? So in private schools, it is legal in New York. In public school, it's not. Hartora, it might be. I mean, officially speaking, it's legal as a private school. I think they don't have it on the books. But there are only two states in the United States that private schools, it's also illegal, which is New Jersey and I think, I don't know, Maryland, some other place. But in the United States, last year, 70,000 children were legally beaten in school by their teacher. And there was one district in Missouri that brought it back in October. It had been outlawed by the local government, and parents said, please bring it back, apparently. And they brought back corporal punishment in school. And again, the assumption is not people hate children, want to beat them. The assumption was, maybe this is more humane than suspending them from school. And humane meaning, what is going to help the kid more? It's true, nobody likes to be hit. And I'm not recommending or endorsing it per se. I haven't studied the issue. But some have concluded, if I suspend them from school for a week, they get behind in their studies. They have the stigma of being an excluded child. What are they going to do at home? Yeah, play machines, go to the store, muck around. I mean, it's not helping anybody. You know, it's more humane because they're not getting hit, but it's actually ruining their trajectory in life. If you take them to the principal's office and you scare them and they think they're going to hit me with a cane.
Spare the rod.
Right, so there's a proverb that would often be quoted that if you spare the rod, you spoil the child. And again, I don't know where to fall on this. I don't know if it's illegal in America to hit one's children at home. I know in England that's now been made, I think, criminal. I'm not sure. I know it was entertained. I can't remember whether it was passed or not. But you can certainly have child services take away children if there's abuse in the home. I just don't know what the threshold for abuse is. But the assumption is, you know what? Sending somebody to sit in the corner is not actually helpful educationally to them. Giving them a hit might change the trajectory in their life. And that's the assumption anyway on this Amud, that Malchus is not about primitive infliction of pain. It is trying to find the most humane way to correct behavior that doesn't ruin somebody's life, even though it's going to hurt. But, you know, you committed a crime. So we need to find a way to help you get better. And if this is it, this is it. But if you get embarrassed along the way, I don't need to hit you if you've now become ashamed. Because for the rest of your life, next time you think of eating pig, you're going to think to yourself, I was standing in a room full of scholars, full of family members, full of friends, and I wet myself. And I'm standing there, I'm ashamed. I can't do this. And you didn't have to skip out on life for 10 years, whatever the case may be. I ran away. I couldn't take the court. You're going to think the rest of your life, next time I'm going to commit a crime, I had to run away from the court. And that's meant to haunt you in some sense. Okay, let's... final Mishnah. And this, again, is the culmination of this Masechta. And this third parak has been about what are we lashing you for? What kind of crimes? And we've said when it comes to harm, that doesn't come up at all. The first Mishnah was about having relationships that are prohibited when nobody's being physically hurt, eating foods that are prohibited when nobody's physically hurt. The second Mishnah was about eating foods that are essentially permitted, just not yet. Maaseh Sheni, you can't have till Yerushalayim, but you eat it early, you get in trouble. The third Mishnah was about ripping your skin or scratching yourself. It's my body. We said, no, it's not. The fourth Mishnah was putting tattoos that's now under your skin. We're getting closer to what you might think is mine and untouchable by the government. That's tattoos. The fifth Mishnah was, if I commit multiple crimes at the same time, this is when you pull the plow through the field with the animals, and you're a Nazir, and you're in a cemetery, and you're on a hill where they did an Eglat Rufa. And we said, again, what are we getting at? We're getting at, in your mind, you've committed 8 crimes in one move, even though it's one act. You thought 8 different things when you were doing it, and that's what's being penalized. And then Mishnah 6 and 7 and 8 we did last time, which was about assessments, how many, and then 8 last time was what is the purpose, and now we're on 9. Kol chayv ikrisa shalaku. Anybody who was chayv kares that got lashes, niftru yidei kritatam, they're no longer chayv kares. Now this is, the Gemara is going to say in a moment, that's an astonishing claim. Who's in charge of dispensing kares? God gives out kares. And we say, oh, if you give somebody chayav kares lashes, you don't get kares. What's the Gemara going to say? How do you know? What are you have you God told you that? What are you talking? How do you know you don't get garis? But we'll get that's the assumption being made here. Shnei Amar, it says v'nikla achicha le'inecha. It says your brother shall be demeaned in your eyes. And the order of the verse makes it sound v'nikla, you become demeaned, achicha, they are now your brother. Doesn't matter they were a criminal. Once they've been demeaned, they re-enter society fully. And the assumption is, therefore, kares also falls away. The same sage says, how many times do I have to kill somebody in order to be killed? Punished, capital punishment. Once. I commit murder. I can say, oh, it was just once. It was one bad decision. And this comes up sometimes in contemporary law. When the Me Too movement got kicked off, there was a 22-year-old or 21-year-old boy from college who one of his college peers said, you know, he took me behind the bicycle shed and he harassed me, sexually assaulted me, etc., etc. It ended up being substantiated, the claim, and the father wrote to the judge a long letter saying, look, my boy made one mistake. One mistake, and you're going to ruin his life for one mistake. And I think there was some sympathy to the... We all make mistakes. One moment you're going to find the rest of his life, and here the assumption is, that's how much weight should be on every decision that we make. You can do one wrong thing. It was just one murder. It was like a crazy moment. I did something I would never do. Okay, but you do one bad thing, you get in trouble. But here the opposite is being inferred from Chanami Gamliel. If you commit one crime and you lose your life because of that one moment, imagine doing one good deed. We tend to imagine I do one crime and I get killed. How many mitzvahs do I have to do to get reward? And it's, well, if one crime gets you killed, imagine what one good deed does. One moment can define eternity. You are given life for one good deed. You don't have to just make that by implication. This is taught, he says. It says, the soul will be cut off for the people who commit these kares-bearing crimes. And it goes on to say, and if you do this, you will live. Meaning, if you don't break these kares-bearing crimes, you will live. It sounds like just not committing crime is itself a mitzvah, which teaches you that if you don't commit kares, your life is bequeathed with meaning. Full stop. It says in the pasuk, and we've got a number of observations about crime and punishment. We're told, don't eat the blood, because the dam is life, so it's prohibited to eat blood. And the verse continues, we don't have it in the mission, the verse continues, and you will be rewarded for generations to come if you don't eat blood. Rabbi Shimon bar Rebbe says, Ma'im hadam shenafshu shaladim katsim imenu, just as blood, which we recoil from. Who wants to eat blood? Nobody wants to eat blood, is the assumption. And haporish memenu makabal schar, and the Torah says, and you for all generations will get reward if you distance yourself from something which you're naturally not predisposed toward. Gezel va'arayot, theft and sexual immorality, which the human nature is inclined to crave. Of course, if you don't do it, all the more so, you get reward for generations and generations to come. Meaning the Torah says, if you don't eat blood, you'll have generational reward. Okay, I'm not going to eat blood, that's fine. And the point is, God is trying to promise that if you separate from something you've got no interest in, you'll get massive rewards. If you separate from something you are interested in, of course you'll get huge reward. Careful, don't say Kaddish. This is the last end of the Mishnah of Marcos, which again finishes with the premise. What are mitzvot all about? Why does God have these religious laws? Don't commit sexual immorality. Don't eat foods you're not meant to be eating. Don't eat shrotzim. Who cares, God? Why are you telling me what I can and can't eat? The assumption here again is, God wants to do what? What does lezakot mean? How do you translate that?
Give merit.
So there are two ways to translate. The most usual translation is lezakot is to give zchut, is to give merit. And this reading assumes, why does God tell you don't eat blood? I'm not going to eat blood anyway, so why does God tell you don't eat blood? Because God wants to give me reward. He says, look, there's blood in the world. You're not going to eat it. So what? I'll tell you it's prohibited. And when you don't eat it, you'll get rewards. I'll just multiply merits. And there's another way. Zikui can mean not just to get merit, but to purify. Zikui kesef is to purge silver of impurities. So another reading by some of the commentators is God wanted lezakot to purify humankind. And that's what mitzvot are for. And that's a radically different reading. It's not just, arbitrarily I'm giving you merits for not doing things you wouldn't do anyway. But God wants you to recognize that in restraining yourself from eating prohibited foods, you will be a better human being. You will be a better citizen, a better parent, a better friend, a better member of community by having restraint in all sorts of ways. And that's what these mitzvot are for. When God says, don't eat shratzim and you'll get whipped if you don't, it's not God saying, I just want to give you a reward. It's God saying, these punishments are about fostering a good society, and having restraint is part of that. So God wants to reward or purify Israel. Afikach, therefore, hibulam to mitzvot. There are many, many commands. Shnei ma'ashem, chavei tzman, sitko, yagdil Torah v'yadir. And that verse is the proof. Full stop. Okay. Let's barrel through. Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan said, chalukin lav chaveiro al Rabbi Chanan Gamliel. Many people disagree, said Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Chanan Gamliel, who said at the beginning of the Mishnah, that if you chayv kares, get malchus, and your kares disappears. He says, many people disagree with that. How do we know? Amar Rav Abba Avra. Rav Abba Avra says, Amar Rabbi Rav Taninan. There was a Mishnah taught in the house of Rav. Ein ben Shabbos Yom Kippur, meshazud don't be adam v'zidom rei kares. There's no difference between Shabbos and Yom Kippur in terms of punishment, other than if you break Shabbos, you get put to death by court. If you break Yom Kippur, what happens? You get kares. So it's very strange that Yom Kippur, we tend to imagine the breach of Yom Kippur is more strict. But if you break Shabbos, you're put to death. You break Yom Kippur, we say, okay, your life is in God's hands. Vim Itan, if you're right, Reb Chanan Megamliel, that you get malchus, you don't have kares anymore. I divide Bnei Adam Hu. Breaking Yom Kippur, you should get malchus, which would get rid of your kares. Reb Nachman Yitzchak Omer, Hamani, let me resolve this for you. Who must be taking the opinion in that Mishnah that says Yom Kippur and Shabbos are the same? Reb Yitzchak, it must be Reb Yitzchak who came up right at the beginning of this perek. Dama Malkus Bechayvi Krasis Leker, it says you don't get Malkus and Kris and Kares together. Two fundamentally different things. The Tanya says, Torah Yitzchak Omer, Chayvi Krasis Bechlal Ayu. Reb Yitzchak said in the context of Arayos that it says, if you do any of these Arayos, you get Kares. Velama Yitzchak Kares Bechoto. And then it says, and if you sleep with your sister, you get Kares. So it says you get Kares for all the Arayos. Why specify it with your sister as well in particular? And his answer is, Laduna Bechares for Labamalkus, to say that you only get Kares and you don't get Malkus for any of these Lavim. So they don't come together. So it's probably his view in the Mishnah that says Yom Kippur and Shabbos are different in that way because you don't get Malkus and Kares together. Rav Ashi Omer, first one line is Kares. Rav Ashi says, Afilu Tem Rabbanan. No, maybe you could say that Mishnah is even Rabbanan. And what they mean is as follows. Zeh, on Shabbos, Ikar Zedona B'dei Adam. The main form of punishment is in court because you get executed. Zeh, Yom Kippur, Ikar Zedona B'dei Shamayim. The main form of punishment is through heaven. Even though Malkus exists, Kares is the main thing. That's from heaven. Full stop. So the concluding point is, if you are chayv kares, Reb Chanan said, if you have malchus, Reb Chanan said, malchus gets rid of the kares, and the Gemara says, that's what we follow. Kares disappears. And as Jerry asked, the Gemara is now going to say, first one line is Rav, Amrav Yosef in the middle, Man salik le'ela va'atavama, who went up to heaven and came back and told us, what do you mean kares disappears? How do you know, Reb Chanan, yeah? And how do we know we follow that rule? Amalei Abaya. Abaya says, that's your question? Who went up to heaven and told you? What is that quote? Who died and went to heaven and, or who made you pope or something like that? Right, who died and made you king? So who died and told you the halacha? So Abaya says, Allah hada amar Rabbi Shua ben Levi. Hold on, haven't you heard about Rabbi Shua ben Levi's statement? Shlosha dvarim asu beisdin shalmata v'eskimu beisdin shalmala al yadam. There were three things that beisdin did on earth that God approved of up high. Man salik le'la v'atavama, who went up there and told us? Meaning all the time we have sages who make remarks about heaven agreeing with us on earth, and nobody's been up there to tell us. Ela k'rai k'darshinam. Hachanami k'rai k'darshinam. We can expound from verses what God's intent is. That is the assumption. On the basis of our interpretation, we can determine heaven's intention. Full stop. And now we're going to have two collections, relatively brief collections, identifying what these three things were, and then we'll reflect on a couple of different batei dinim. Gufa. Hold on a minute. You just quoted Rabbi Shmuel ben Levi. Rabbi Shmuel ben Levi says, "Shloshet dvarim asu beis shamayim adam iskim beis shamala al yadam." Three things that beis din on earth did that in heaven they agreed to. What are they? Elohen, Mikra, Megillah. Shela, Shalom, Bavet, Maser. The first is the obligation to read Megillah. Who said that you have to read Megillah? Who came up with that law? Did God tell Moshe on Sinai? Who set this mitzvah? Right, it seems like the Anshei Knesset Hagdola or Mordechai or Esther. Someone said you've got to read it, but the assumption is God approved. Shela Shalom, that you can greet somebody in the name of God. When do we greet anybody with the name of God? Shalom Aleichem. Is that the name of God? So Shalom is seen as the name of God. So Shabbat Shalom or Shalom Aleichem is seen as using the name of God. In fact, there are halachas that apply to how you should greet somebody in the morning before tefillah. It's possible you shouldn't say shalom to somebody in the morning. You shouldn't use God's name before you've prayed to God, so you say good morning or something instead. But that's the assumption. Right. Anyone ever did Bnei Akiva? I think that's how they start the song. Say Hashem Imachem, and then they all put their feet together, and then they sing the Bnei Akiva song that I can't remember what it's called. V'havet Maser, and bringing Maser. Mikra Megillah, how do I know Mikra Megillah? It says the Jews established and received it. Kimu lamala mashikibu lamata. The verse means they accepted on high what they accepted down below. Shela shalom. What about giving greetings? As Seth said, dichtiv inei Boaz ba mebeit lechem v'omi lakotz v'mashem machem. Boaz said to the threshers in the field, God's with you, as a greeting. Va'omer, and it says Hashem imcha gibor achayel. And the angel approached Gideon when he first saw him. And they said, God is with you. So you use God's name. My va'omer, why do you have to use the second? Just use Boaz. Why do you need Gideon and the angel? You might think Boaz made this decision, but who said God agreed? Tashma va'omer, that's why we teach Hashem Chabu Achayel, that the angel did the same thing. Ravet Maser, what about bringing Maser? And on the left, in the Rivan, you've got about 15 lines describing what this means. There were various pronouncements and enactments made by Chizkiah and Ezra about what happened to the Maser. For example, you have to take Maser from apples. So let's say they grow in Israel. You have to take Maser. So the assumption is, no, Maser is from grain. There are Bikurim, you bring from apples, but Maser doesn't come. So Ezra made a takan along with Hizkiyahu that you have to take Maser from these foods too. So the, in the end, the answer is yes, but this was an enactment. How do we know it was accepted? It says, there's a long verse in Chronicles that assumes that this enactment on the part of Chizkiyahu was accepted on high. What does it mean, until there is not enough? Amram Barav, until you have worn out your mouth from saying enough. Full stop. Let's go through this quickly. There were three times in history that Ruach HaKodesh appeared in court. Based in Shal Shem, in the court of Shem, based in Shal Shmuel Aramati, in the based in Shmuel, based in Shal Shlomo, and in the Beit Din of Shlomo. Based in Shal Shem, when did God appear? And these are stories we've probably heard or read a number of times and thought, yeah, that makes complete sense. And it's now going to sound like the Gemara says that would not be logical if not for God's intervention. Dichtiv. How do we know in the court of Shem, which was being occupied by Judah as the judge at the time, Tamar is standing there. Tamar said, oh, you want to know why I'm pregnant and who I had a relationship with? This signet ring belongs to the person who had a relationship with me. At which point, Judah turns around and says, oh, you know, she's right. Manayada, how does he know she's right? How does he know that he's the father? Maybe he consulted with her and somebody else consulted with her. What proof does he have that those are his children? Yatsa bat kol va'amra mimeni yatsa kvushim. Which is why it wasn't him that said mimeni. It was a disembodied heavenly voice that said, secrets come from me. And that's intervention. But based on Shmuel, also I've been in Shmuel's Beit Din. Dechtiv, hanini anu bi neged Hashem, v'neged Mishicho, et shokin lachaktiv, v'yom la shakni v'lo ritzanoni, v'yom eid Hashem, v'eid Mishicho, there's a back and forth where Shmuel said, King says, I never took anything from you. And the people said, you never took anything from us. And Shmuel and Shaul says, you should be a witness. And then it says, Vayomer aid. And he said, we are witness. But the singular Vayomer is an odd, it should say Vayomru. Vayomer, Vayomer Mubaile, it should say, and they responded rather than he. Yatsa bat kol va'amra ani eid b'dar hazeh. It wasn't the people who responded, it was heaven that responded. B'vedin shel Shlomo, famous case of Solomon's court. How do we know that the heavenly presence manifested? I'm sure we're familiar with Solomon's case. Two women come to the court, they both had babies. One of the babies passed away overnight, one left. And the two mothers came to the court of Solomon and said, this baby's mine. The other one said, this baby's mine. And what was Shlomo's compromise? I'm sure you've heard of the mother-in-law joke. Yeah, right. Cut him in half. That's the mother-in-law. So he says, cut the baby in half. And one mother says, no, I'd rather they had it. And the other one says, yeah, fine with me. Cut it in half. And Shlomo's response is, obviously, that's the mother. Now, is that guaranteed? Yeah, no. Maybe the mother says, I'm so distraught, I can't tolerate this. I would rather the baby was cut in half than I had to spend the rest of my life watching the baby being brought up by that woman. And the other one might say, oh no, please don't cut up my baby. And it's an act to sound more motherly. How does Shlomo know to guarantee? So it must be, the Gemara assumes, Mana Yada, first one lines to me too. How does he know? Dilma Urame Arme, maybe the whole thing's a scheme. Yatsa bat kol va'amra hi imo. So it wasn't Shlomo that said she's the mother, it was a bat kol. Full stop. We've had three cases where it would seem on face value it's impossible for Yehuda or Shlomo or Shmuel to know that this is the case. Must be that there's intervention on the part of God. Amar Rava Mimai. Rava says, how do you know that? Maybe this is logical. Dilma Yehuda, given the chashiv yarchev yomei v'drameh, he calculated the days. He knew how long in the pregnancy she was. The chazin maskin v'la chazin la maskin. And he said, I can establish it was me. I've calculated. She's 8 months pregnant. I know when I was there. I'm obviously the father. Shmuel Nami, Kulu Yisrael Kari Leblashin Yechidi. It's quite possible when the people Vayomer aid in the singular respond, it's talking about a whole nation. Dechtiv Yisrael No Shabashem. Sometimes the singular is used to speak to a whole nation. Shlomo Nami, in the case of Solomon too. Mida Kamarachma Vahala Kamarachna. She had mercy and she didn't. It's obvious who the mother is. Nobody turned and said, I'd rather you killed my baby. Nobody would say that. So maybe what Shlomo's doing, it was based in fact, Ella Gemara, okay, you're right, it must be not proof on the basis of verses, but there's tradition that God manifests in court sometimes, which again, this all comes to color. The practice of court is to adjudicate law, facilitate society, and there are times in which in the record of Tanakh, it seems to go beyond that, and we assume that's a manifestation of God's presence. Full stop. Next time we'll begin with this famous ending of Masechet Makot, which will begin with how many mitzvot are there in the Torah? 613. And we're going to say, how do we know that? And then we're going to have, progressively over time, prophets whittle it down to 11 laws, 6 laws, 3 laws, 2 laws, 1 law. What is Torah all about? That's what we'll get to next time. In the meantime, Yasher Koach, we've got one more daf, one more week, and then we'll be done. And next week we'll leave another couple of lines over and we'll finish on Shavuos. Second day we'll have a Siyum and a Kiddush.